This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 67. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How you doing this week, Rob?
Doing pretty good, man. I'm feeling good. Just continuing to move along with Hittail stuff. I'm a little over 2 weeks after the launch, or the relaunch, I should say, and had a post go big on Hacker News last week. I don't know if it went to number one 4 or 5 hours later, and it was at number two with 100-something votes. So my guess is it hit number one at one point. But I got quite a few new trial signups, which is good, and good feedback, and just got a lot of folks in there kind of mucking around in it, which is cool.
Neat.
There's this other thing that's killing me. I've been getting these emails. I need to rant for a bit, but there's like a lesson in this rant. I've been getting a few emails from LegalZoom because they are changing their affiliate program. And I'm an affiliate because I blogged about them, you know, starting businesses and stuff. LegalZoom is actually, it's a decent, inexpensive service for getting your paperwork, your LLC filings, or whatever you're going to do, corporate stuff. And so I have an affiliate link on my blog from, you know, posts years ago. And they are doing exactly what you should not do, but they are requiring everyone to update their affiliate links. And to me, that just sucks.
Oh, that does suck.
It sucks because it screws me. Because if I don't go back and do it, the traffic still goes to them and it just means they don't have to pay me.
Oh.
Right? Because they're not going to track it anymore because they're shutting down this old thing. I mean, I'm like pretty bitter about this. It's a similarly short-sighted decision of companies that have a billing plan and then they switch and they require all the old people to go sign up again and you lose at least half, maybe more of your customers. As an example, with Hittail, it's all, you know, all the old stuff is on basic PayPal subscriptions and I switched it to Stripe. I did not make a single person re-sign up. Like I'm running parallel billing processes, which means I have if statements on probably 8 different pages to say, if you're using old billing code, then this, and if you're on the new billing plans, then this. And it is a pain in the butt for me. But bottom line is, it's the right thing to do. And I just feel like, I guess LegalZoom, they don't need to do it because they will still get the traffic. It makes me bitter.
I fail to see the problem from their end on this.
Yeah. How about you? What's going on?
My trip to LA was cut about a week short, so I'm back in Massachusetts again. So just been trying to get settled again.
Well, hey, I wanted to let a caller know. Someone called and left us what I think is a really good message. It was 90 seconds and it was filled with some good info, but it was just breaking up all over the place. It sounded like he was having cell phone issues. So the caller who called about IELTF, and I don't even know what that means because that's like one of the few snippets I heard. Please call back from the landline. We'd love to have your question on the show, but wasn't able to make it out.
Another listener had emailed us and let us know that we apparently have more reviews in iTunes than we previously thought. And it turns out if you look at the reviews, it only shows reviews for your geographic region. Yeah, I guess he looked at the reviews and he didn't see as many as we see because, you know, ours are coming from the U.S. And I forget what country he was writing in from. Obviously, a much smaller country, but there were reviews there that I'd just never seen before. He even sent me a screenshot to show me and I mashed them up with what I saw on iTunes. And they just weren't there.
How cool. It would be nice to be able to see them. I would like to see like we're huge in Japan or everyone in New Zealand hates us or something, right? It would be nice to get those somehow.
Yep, it would be nice, but there's probably a setting someplace in iTunes.
So there's a app that just came out for iOS I wanted to tell people about. I was actually in the support chat room for Stripe, which is payment processing, and I was asking him something, and someone popped in there because it's a campfire chat room, which is public. Someone's like, hey, my iOS app for Stripe just got approved, and apparently the guy knew the other guy who I was talking to. So if you have Stripe and you want to charge people stuff like on the go, like at dinner, if we split a check or something, I could just put your credit card right in and suck money out of it onto my Stripe account. He got it approved and he said it was a big headache because I guess the financial apps in the app store go under more scrutiny, mm-hmm. which makes sense, right? But he said it took him quite a long time, number of revisions and such to get it through. So it's called Tiger Pay and it's $1.99, which these prices still just kill me. You know, it's like I almost might have that on my phone just to have it at that price.
That is pretty cool. So from my end, listeners are probably a little bit anxious to hear what sort of things I've been doing on Audit Shark, especially given my trip to LA last week, which kind of cuts into my time to work on it, but I'm still working through some issues with the beta tester that I signed on. The Windows service doesn't seem to be responding on that end, but I haven't checked the logs to figure out exactly what's going on. So that's a kind of an ongoing issue that I'll probably just have to deal with, and more for the initial installation than anything else. But I'm sure it's something I can work around, or something that I didn't mention in the installer. So, right. But other than that, in terms of the marketing, I got a short list of about 30 banks in the area who I'm hoping to go visit later this week. I probably won't get to all of them. I'll probably get to maybe 5 or 6 or something like that. But I'm essentially looking to go into those and either pre-qualify them or tweak my marketing message a little bit and just kind of learn a little bit more from them about how I would kind of get in front of them and their peers. I also found out that there's a company called AccuData where I can buy contact information by industry. So you essentially put in a industry code. I think it's called an SIC code. And thinking about maybe doing a postcard campaign to people that I find through AccuData and see if I can't drum up some leads and prospects without physically going and meeting with each of them. Mm-hmm. So, and even if it's just leads, I mean, at least that allows me to get in front of people. And if it's something that they're really interested in, chances are good that they'll try and reach out to me instead of me having to go in and saying, is this something you're interested in? No. Okay. Well, then I just wasted an hour of my time.
An alternative could be to have a VA kind of go through Google Maps, you know, based on your location and put together a small list of 50 or 100 or something. But
yeah,
depends on how much the cost is, I guess, you know, of AccuData stuff.
It's like 12 cents per record. It's ridiculously cheap.
Jeez. I mean, so that'll be worth it.
I looked in just this geographic area and it came up with something like 1,500 or 1,700 listings or something like that. At 12 cents a piece, it was only $170. So that's dirt cheap.
Right. Totally worth it. Like I said last time, I would consider not doing a postcard and actually doing a first class letter. I just think you have a much higher hit rate, especially if you explain kind of what you're doing and not just make it a sales pitch, but be like, hey,
right,
I'm a local guy and here's what I'm doing type thing. So mm-hmm. Just an idea.
Yep. Yep. I probably will go that route instead of just a postcard, but
yeah, more personal. Well, cool. Anything else?
Working through a website redesign for Audit Shark. So I haven't really figured out exactly what I want to do yet, but
sounds, you know, like you need to talk to the banks before you do that, you know?
Yeah, because I want to talk to these people first and then try and figure out what the rest of the messaging is. But I did come up with what I think is a pretty good messaging earlier this week, because whenever I talk to people and I start explaining what Audit Shark does, they say, well, that sounds great, but I don't really understand this piece or that piece or possibly even why they need it. And one of the data points that I can point back to is some more recent research in the past year or so from Verizon that basically said that there are no documented cases in the past, I forget what the time period was, but basically where they said that vulnerabilities were a direct result of the hacking cases. It was more system misconfigurations than anything else, which is exactly what Audit Shark is designed for. The study went on to say that although those things are important, obviously you should be doing them, they, you know, aren't necessarily the cause of the vast majority of the people who get hacked. So I was thinking about going through and creating kind of a marketing campaign around that that basically just says 95% of all, you know, security breaches are due to this. Are you covered? Or something along those lines. Like I said, I have to go talk to these people and figure out if that's something that I think would work or not.
Right. Very good.
So way back in episode 8, we talked about the importance of building a mailing list. And I went back and I took a look at some of our later episodes and even episodes around that. We never really discussed specific strategies for driving people to the mailing list. I mean, we talked in generalities, but we never really dug into the specifics of the things that you should do on your site to help drive the people to the mailing list and increase your conversion rate for that mailing list.
So the title is Specific Mailing List Strategies for Growing Your List and Managing Your List?
I mean, we can go into the managing list. It depends on how much time we have left.
Cool. What should people know first?
So I think the first thing you need to know is what you're eventually going to use this list for. Because if you're trying to drive people to your mailing list to, for example, get them on a pre-launch mailing list, you're going to handle it a little bit differently than if you've already launched your product or you're trying to do a targeted promotion in a specific type of person, a specific type of buyer, or somebody in a specific industry.
I agree. I think this is a key thing that people don't talk about often. They kind of say, well, I have a newsletter list, an email mailing list. That can have many meanings, right? It can be, as you said, a targeted launch for what comes to mind is like MicroConf. Like we had a targeted list for that conference. You could have a targeted launch list that is for your startup, for a book you write, for something that is going to come at a specific point in time. And essentially, the list is disposable, right? The list, you're going to use it, and then you're going to get rid of it. You're not going to email it a year down the line when you need something else. It's not good etiquette. If you tell them they're going to hear about a launch, then that's what it should do. But there are some other ones as well. There's like a customer list. And so someone buys your book. Obviously, if it's a SaaS app, they're just a customer all the time. But if they buy a one-time use product, like invoicing software or just any type of downloadable software, you keep them in your customer list. And you might email them periodically. You give them the opportunity to unsubscribe. Even if you only email them, you know, a few times a year, if they are a customer, they do tend to want to hear from you as long as you're not sending them crappy sales stuff. But if you're sending them like, hey, there's an update, come download it. Or hey, there's a new version, you know, an audio version of the material. And these are all things that I've done. That customer list is also an email list, but it's a lot different than that launch list. And then the other two that I've seen most commonly are like, actually Plugio does this really well, Justin Vincent's Twitter client. There's a 5-day e-course and it's an email course. So you go to plugio.com and something pops up, you enter your email and he has really solid tips that come out 5 days right in a row. I mean, he's obviously marketing to you as well, but it's not some ongoing newsletter that goes on for 6 months or a year. It's this very specific thing he tells you up front and then you get this good information. And then I think the fourth kind that comes to mind is like if you were to go to my blog, I have an ongoing newsletter that is going to go on for, you know, however long I can continue to write it, but it basically sends you an email every 2 weeks and it potentially will go on for years. And that's different tips about, you know, startups, entrepreneurship, all that stuff. So those are the four kind of email mailing lists that come to mind.
Yeah. And the point of all that is that there may even be overlap between these lists. I mean, as you said, you've got a customer list and then you may have a mailing list that you put together to let your customers know about a specific product launch that you're having. Maybe it's a plug-in or an add-on or module or something along those lines. And maybe you're trying to get feedback or you're trying to get people on a beta list. There's a very big difference between those lists that you want to keep around for a long time versus those ones where if it's a product launch, you're going to drive people to that mailing list and get them on the list. And then once you've mailed them maybe once or twice or, you know, whatever the course of your mailing cycle is, that list is basically gone at that point because the expectation that you have set to those users about how long they're going to be on it and what the purpose of that mailing list that they signed up for, it's gone. There's no reason for you to be emailing them after that. So you do have to be a little bit careful about, you know, what expectations you're putting forth, not only for your users, but for yourself as well.
That's right. And I think that ties into what you said earlier of being very specific about it upfront is going to go a long way towards giving people expectations of how many emails they're going to receive and how long they're going to receive them for.
And that kind of leads us into the next part, which is determining what conditions you're going to try and drive people to that list. So, for example, on a pre-launch for a product, you might try to drive people to that mailing list from every page on your website because your goal is to drive people to that list so that you can mail them later on or you can let them know about new updates regarding when the software is going to be available or maybe tips and tutorials, things like that. Again, the expectation that you've put forth is that that's a launch mailing list. And when you have launched, after you've launched, you send them a couple of emails, let them know, and that's the end of it.
I've actually gotten this question quite a bit, like whether you should keep separate lists for customers and prospects. And the answer is absolutely, because the information that goes to the two of them is completely different. You're gathering them different ways, and the information that you're sending them should almost, it will never overlap.
Now, question for you. I mean, obviously, you have a bunch of different products, but do you have specific landing pages whose sole purpose is to drive somebody to a mailing list to try and gather an email address from them?
Well, it depends on the cycle of the product. So like MicroConf, the website, once the conference was over last year, we basically just put a big, be notified about MicroConf 2012 up in the upper right. But that was our main call to action. Mm-hmm. And actually still is right now because we're only in early bird sales. So next week there will be a button on it where people can buy the tickets. And then once the conference is over again, we'll do the same thing. So in that sense, yes. And then when I first launched my book, I had a landing page, you know, that drove people there. We actually do that with the Micropreneur Academy as well. If you go to micropreneur.com, And that's pretty much what, you know, all people can do. You can enter an email to be notified, but we don't really allow people to buy in directly because we want to take people in as cohorts so we're able to work with them.
Right. The one thing I was wondering more about was in terms of using like Google AdWords to drive somebody to a page, and you have a landing page that's very specific to the people that you're advertising to.
Yep. So I'm trying to think. I don't think I do now. I have in the past. We had several different landing pages for .NET Invoice AdWords campaigns, and they were, the idea was to tie into the ad so that when someone clicked on an ad, that headline they just clicked on appeared in the landing page when they got there, and it's to give them continuity of thought. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, but not right now.
I wonder if that kind of indicates a change in, you know, marketing strategies. I guess it's probably more because you rely a lot less on Google AdWords now than you did in the past.
That's right. Yeah, I don't think I have anything running right now for .NET Invoice. You know, I am going to toy around with it with Hittail. I'm frankly, these days, I'm a little skeptical of Google AdWords purely because of the cost is so high right now. And there's other networks that are just cheaper these days. If I do any advertising and I'm driving people to a landing page, like with Hittail, which will probably be the next advertising campaign that I wind up setting up, I will absolutely have multiple landing pages. And there will be very similar, but it will be customized text on each of them.
Okay. So the next step in the process is making the sign-up process as painless as possible. And it's interesting because I did some research earlier today looking at the sign-up forms that other people had available. And if you just do a Google search for mailing list sign-up, and I just looked at the top four or five different pages, and without fail, like each of them was about half a page long. It was ridiculous the length that these people were making people go through in order to just sign up for a mailing list. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, there were probably 10, 15 fields on each of these things.
Yeah, you know, there's actually a pretty easy way to get rid of most of those things, especially with an email form. It depends. If you're doing enterprise sales, as you know, you want as much information as possible. You want to create a lead rather than just, you know, get the email and contact them. And so you want to get phone, you want to get company so you can look them up and research them and prioritize the leads because you get more than you can follow up with. And then you want to give them a call and all this stuff. And that's fine. But I think in the spaces that we're in, not selling six-figure software, I think you really, really need to minimize, at least starting out, minimize the number of form fields you ask for. Typically, I recommend it's either first name and email or just email. That's it. I keep it simple, you know? I think beyond that, I mean, even I was working with a registration form that I was trying to pare down. There's so many things you can do to not ask for information. And it's amazing that eliminating each one of those actually improves your conversion rate. Is a little separate from emails, but even like a registration form, I see a lot of forms that say username, email, password, confirm password, password hint, and then asks for a bunch of other stuff. And it's like, let's look at those five fields. Why do you need a username if you have an email? Make their email their username, get rid of that one. Why do you confirm their password? If they enter a password that they don't, you know, they accidentally fat finger it, one out of 20 people will do that, they can come back and reset their password. You have their email. A password hint, you can always get from them later. Do you really need one? They're going to just reset it anyways. You know, there's all these things. I mean, you can basically take those five fields down to two fields, just an email and a password. And so I would use similar mindset here, even to the point of geolocating someone if you need like a time zone. That was one thing on the Hittail registration page. It's asking for time zone. And I eliminated that by using some JavaScript. With email forms, if you really, number one, if you aren't going to use the information, absolutely do not have it on the form, even if it's optional. All optional fields should be gone. Everything should be required. And number two, make that thing two, maybe three form fields.
The other thing that you can do for, and I guess this doesn't necessarily apply to mailing lists, but it applies more to sign up pages for an application. You can essentially just ask for, as you said, the email address and a password. And then once they get into the application, you can have a page where they can fill out a profile that has some of that other information that you want or need. And you just have messages that pop up in various places that say, you have not filled out your profile.
Totally. And I'm totally planning to do that because I do want to know more about, you know, some of the folks. Once people become paying customers, I would love to know more about them just so I have an idea of who's using my app. And I'm absolutely planning to do that. Once the trial is up, I'll be pinging people and saying, hey, you know, it'd be great if you could fill out your profile. And I'll probably figure out a way to motivate them. You know, it's like if you fill it out, you get 7 days free, you get 14 days free, you get a discount this month, something like that. That way you're removing that friction at the front end of the process.
And if they're already signed into the application, they're already seeing what benefits it can provide them. And hopefully, if they're interested in still using it, they'll just go ahead and fill out that profile because they don't want to see some red message someplace. The next step is to use an ESP, and essentially that is an email service provider. Hosting your old email, as we said before, is a bad idea. I mean, you're hosting your own email list, sending your own emails through your own server. You can get flagged for spam very, very quickly. And the tools provided by these ESPs are pretty good for post-email analysis. And they tell you things like what your open rate was, you know, what the click-through rate was, if people are clicking on links inside the email, et cetera. So you've got a lot of additional tools that they give you. And it doesn't really cost a whole heck of a lot for, you know, any of these mailing list providers. I mean, you've got Constant Contact, you've got MailChimp, you've got AWeber. They're all pretty reasonably priced. I think with MailChimp, you can have up to 2,000 people on your mailing list and it's free. And then other ones, even after that, a few thousand people, it's only $20 or $30 a month.
So I definitely agree. ESPs, I mean, I use MailChimp and have for years, but I also have had success using these more recent like Postmark and SendGrid, these services that allow you to basically pull from directly from your customer database live. So I write a script and it pulls a SQL script. It pulls out of my database based on some very specific criteria. Basically, I create a list on the fly. I pull in an email template that I've written, and then I can swap out stuff in, since you know I'm writing code, I can swap out stuff in that email and highly customize it to that person. I can include their domain name, their number of hits they got last month. I mean, just very specific things. And then I can send it through Postmark. And, you know, the idea is that it has as good a chance of getting delivered as something from MailChimp. You know, I can't recommend that to someone if they're not a developer or don't have a developer who can build that for them. But I've had a lot of success with customizing that stuff and having decent conversion rates as I'm emailing folks to remind them, hey, like you're still sending us traffic and we have this many suggestions for you. And I can actually say, like, we have 340 suggestions for you from the past 2 months on this URL. If you're interested, come sign up again. And here's the customized URL. You click right here and it reactivates their account. It's got stuff in the query string. So that's another option. Now, that's a little different than if you have a newsletter, if you have a 5-day email sign-up course, then obviously that's not the way you want to go with it. But for those kind of emails, I think that's maybe the other option. To me, in my mind, that's a new ESP that really doesn't have a front end.
Yeah, and I think you can do the same sorts of things with MailChimp or AWeber if you just export the data from your database and import it, because you can add those custom fields in. If you already have integration points into SendGrid or Postmark app, then you know you may as well use those. I mean, it really, at the end of the day, it comes down to whatever works for you. It's not about, you know, how cool one tool is or what the pricing of those is. It's whatever works and gets the job done.
Yeah, that's right.
So beyond using an ESP, one of the things you want to do is convince the person who's signing up that there is some sort of authority or trust that your site has, that such that when they give their email address, it's not going to be turned over to spammers. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. You know, several things that you can do that are usually pretty quick are just to put simple links to say powered by so-and-so. And that could be MailChimp or AWeber or Constant Contact, whoever your mailing list provider is. Another thing you can do that's very simple is just simply post your privacy statement, a link to it right there. It says, you know, we value your privacy. Pretty much anything that provides you with that trust or that authority to let them know that you're not going to, you know, continuously spam them, that it's going to be easy for them to unsubscribe, and that if they ever don't want to hear from you, then all they need to do is unsubscribe and that's the end of it. Rob, can you think of some specific phrases that you've used in the past to kind of help out with that trust relationship?
You know, what's interesting is a lot of the forms that I use, I don't even address that. I know with some of them, like on my blog, it's kind of like, well, you got to trust I'm putting out good content and then I'm not going to spam you. And these days, like, I think if you're dealing more with non-technical users, then I think this is important. I think dealing with like the startup crowd and entrepreneurs and people who are pretty web savvy, they know that if they enter their email and you start spamming them, they're going to mark you as spam. They can block you. Like, there are options. And typically, they're going to be able to unsubscribe. They know you're using an ESP, and there's always an unsubscribe link at the bottom of that. So I actually think that's less of an issue. I know it is for me. I throw my email around pretty freely into forms, unless it looks super sketchy, even without someone saying, we will never spam you, we promise, which some of the phrases I see, I'll never spam you, no spam ever. I have found that in the forms that I'm actually looking at a bunch of forms I've put together right now, I don't put those. And it's because I didn't have room and I wanted to have more positive talk of what I was going to provide them. Like, I think I upsold the value so much that I get good conversion rates without trying to downplay the spam. Like, downplay the negative is one approach and showing them the upside of what you're giving them is the other. And I've chosen to take the latter.
Right. But I think that in a lot of the things that you've probably put together, just the way they're designed, the way that they're put together is probably helpful in evoking that trust to begin with. If a website looks sketchy, it probably is. And no amount of, you know, we will not spam you can overcome it in certain cases. I mean, it obviously depends on the website. But when you're putting together a product website, most of those product websites are going to look fairly professional. If it's all stuff that you handcrafted the HTML and it's obvious that you did and you didn't do a good job of it, then I think that that's where those things becomes more important. But this whole thing is really about evoking a sense of security and trust that you're not going to do inappropriate things with it. And I think the design of the website can certainly play into that. I mean, just simply saying, you know, we hate spam is one way, but I think that going in the other direction and just that general sense of, you know, trust is another.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the look and the overall feel someone gets is just a big part of it. And if they see, again, when they're reading through the blog or reading through a conference website, it's like, well, I can tell this is a real conference, or I can tell this is a real software product, whether it's any of my apps. It's like, this actually exists and there are real people behind it. The technical user knows that it is not in your best interest to spam them. There's just nothing you can get out of it. You know, it'll only bring you negative things. And so if you are legitimate, spam is just, it's totally not worth your time.
So the last specific strategy for driving people to your mailing list is to offer them something for free in exchange for their email address. And again, this is more for those disposable type mailing lists where you're trying to drive people to a launch list, or, you know, even if it's a new product that's coming out, you can offer them to be part of the beta or new customer feedback, something along those lines. But there's a lot of other things that you can give them as well. You can give them a white paper, an ebook. I think it's SmartBear Software. If you go to their website, you can actually sign up for a free copy of the physical book, or at least you used to. They switched it over to an ebook because I think it got too expensive. But you could sign up, give them your name, address, and they would actually ship you a full-blown paper copy of
Peer Code Reviews.
Yes, that's what it was.
Jason Cohen wrote it. Yeah.
Yep. So they would give you that. And something else you could do is a free consultation if it's a big ticket item, something along those lines. I'm not so sure that giving them a direct discount on your software would work, but, you know, there are certainly things that people can't easily assign a value to that will seem a lot more valuable to them and will kind of convince them or push them over the edge to saying, hey, yeah, I'd love to see that. Let me give you my email address.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm not wild on advertising a discount directly there, because that's just kind of a, you know, that's kind of a lazy way to do it. The way that requires more effort is to create something of value and to think of a really good title for it. Instead of just saying, all right, you get $5 off an order, why not create 10 things you must know before going to the beach this summer, if you're selling beach towels on a website, or 10 things you must know before starting your startup, if you're selling a book, or, you know, I mean, there's ways to do this where you actually provide someone value, and over the long term, you're not just cheapening your offering. So it doesn't work in all cases, but that is typically the default. And in fact, there's a really easy way to create one of these things. I'm gonna let you in on a secret. Basically, if you are an expert, or if you can find an expert and you interview them over Skype, or again, if you're the expert, have someone interview you for a very short time. I mean, you can do like 15, 20 minutes, probably ideal. And all it is some, you know, questions about this very specific topic. And you interview them, then you have it transcribed. You essentially now have an audio product, which people put a lot of value on. And you have a companion PDF. Transcriptions are super cheap. I mean, we get all these episodes transcribed for 50, 60 cents a minute. And so you're going to pay $9 for the transcription, create a decent looking PDF out of it. And now there's your product. Like, you didn't even have to sit down and write 10 pages. You basically have this audio gift, you could call it, or an audio report on this. And it's someone knowledgeable talking about it. So that's something I've been recommending lately to people to try out.
Yeah, something that you mentioned kind of reminded me of something that Patrick McKenzie came up with, or had mentioned in his talk at last year's MicroConf, which was when people are spending other people's money, they don't necessarily care about the price. not offering a discount, especially when you're selling business software, is probably much more appropriate than in a case where maybe you're selling products directly to the consumer. I'm still not wild about the idea of selling a discount, but I suspect that it would work a lot better if you're selling to the end users, your general consumer population, as opposed to business users.
Yeah, I would agree. Just more price sensitivity with consumers. So if people want to comment, they can call it into us at 888-801-9690. They can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. As you might know, our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control, and that is by the band Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we do appreciate a review in iTunes. You can just search for Startups, and we'll be there in the top three or four. And a full transcript, as I said, is always available at startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.